This is the Faherty Podcast presented by Farmers Insurance.
Thank you. Sup? Little different look here. Thank you for that warm welcome. Tonight's guest is Michael Strahan, and in honor of his appearance on my show, I'm wearing his clothes. See? Right? I know what you're thinking. Michael Strahan is 6'4" and has the physique of an Adonis. And I'm less than 6'4" with a physique that's less Adonis and more a donut. But that's all right, because I'm not wearing clothes from his closet, but rather from clothes from his clothing line. Pretty cool, eh? That works. You see, in addition to being a Hall of Fame football legend and an Emmy Award-winning television personality, Michael's got multiple businesses, including his own fashion line. Needless to say, for a man this busy, it was only appropriate to visit him in the city that never sleeps. Rather than driving a ball down the fairway, I'm driving a car through Manhattan to meet Michael Strahan. I'm heading down to Midtown in order to catch up with him right after he wraps up a busy morning of shooting for Good Morning America. Michael, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
No, you kidding me? This is part of my dream of being on the show with you.
I love guests with low standards. Yeah. You know, you've slammed your body into 300-pound linemen, you know, and you work in a show that requires you to get up before some people actually go to bed. What do you rely on? I mean, myself, it's Adderall and a number of other chemical substances.
I rely on gratitude. Yeah. Gratitude. Because when I had to slam into the 300-pound guys, that I actually enjoyed.
Yeah.
I didn't like training camp. So I didn't like training camp where you have to do 2-a-days and you finish your, you wake up the next morning and you have to put on these pads. They're still soggy and wet from the sweat from the day before. They're cold. You got to put them on. You got to stretch on wet grass, cold grass, and then you got to run into guys. That, I did not like it.
Yeah.
But once I finished up my career, everything after that is gravy. So I go to work every day and I'm just happy because I got a job. I don't live with my parents. Like, I can really take care of myself. And it's all fun stuff. It's all fun stuff I get to do.
You were born in Houston, but you grew up on Army bases, right?
Grew up on Army bases. I'm born in Houston, grew up on an Army base in Maryland. Then I grew up on really at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when I was 6 to 9. And my dad was the 82nd Airborne Division, master jumper, paratrooper.
And then we moved to... I said, thank you.
I will. Yeah. You know, I will. 81, almost 82, still going strong. We moved to Germany when I was 9, back in 1981. And my parents were there for 19 years. So I grew up on bases all around the world, and it was incredible because it taught me that the world is a big place, just not the little community that I was born and grew up and never left.
Yeah.
I had a chance to see the world before I was even a teenager, and I think that was a blessing.
You were the youngest of 6?
Yeah.
How big were the other 5?
They're not as big as me now.
No?
So I get back at them now. But I was a baby, and I wasn't that big growing up, and I would follow around my brothers, and I was 13 years old. I'll never forget. I was 13. I'm running behind my brothers and their friends, and we're trying to climb a fence, and they kind of jump over it, and I'm struggling. And one of the friends, they called me Bob because that was my nickname, but I didn't know what it meant.
Bob?
Bob, yeah. And I'm like, okay. And then one of the friends said, you know why we call you Bob? I'm like, no. He goes, it stands for booty on back or big old butt. You know? And I didn't realize, man. I was 4'13", I'm just eating. And so I kind of was a big boned kid. But when that happened growing up with brothers who teased me, it really upset me at first. I cried like a baby. But then it also taught me that I have to toughen up. You're going to be the little brother, you have to toughen up. And I think being the youngest of 6, it taught me to be tough.
Well, there's no crying in baseball, but apparently there's crying in football.
You did your research, didn't you? The first time I played football when I was 7 and 8 at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And when I was 7 years old, I cried the entire game. And I was a good player. I mean, I would make a play and I would just... But I'm not just talking about like... I'm talking about
snot flying.
Snot, tears, snot, everything. And they would pull me out the game. What's wrong? And I'm like, nothing. I'm okay. You okay? Yeah, I'm fine. They put me back in. I make more plays. I cry more. I couldn't stand the attention. Now that I think back, I did not like parents clapping. I did not like anybody yelling my name. The attention just made me emotional and made me cry, and I was shy.
Were you introverted? Yeah.
Yeah. And I still am. People can't tell, but I am.
Yeah, no, I get it.
This is the original kickoff point of everything.
Can you explain the importance of a Kuwahara laser light bicycle?
I was 9 years old. I had a beat-up bike.
Right.
And somebody stole it. And I cried. Like, I cried when they stole the bike, and I wanted a new bike. And of course, as a nine-year-old kid, you find the most expensive bike that you can find with a Kuwahara laser light. And the bike was super expensive. And my dad said, well, you know what? You earn half the money, and I'll come up with the other half. But it took me a few years, possibly, to raise the money. And I'll never forget handing my dad the money, like, here's half of the bike.
Yeah.
And he looked at me like, I didn't expect you to actually come up with it, because I wasn't expecting to come up with the other half. But he came up with the other half of the money, and I still have that bike to this day.
How much was it?
It was over $1,000. I want to say, yeah, back then it was almost $1,000 or more.
Wow.
Which was a lot of money. I could have bought a motorcycle, probably.
Yeah.
And I still have it to this day. It hangs on the wall in my man cave because it's a reminder that if you want something, you have to work for it.
What are you going to do with it?
So my mom asked me at one point, because it was in their attic for years, and she's like, why don't you give it to your son? And I love my son more than anything, but he's not getting a bike. I'll buy him another bike. He can go buy his own bike. He's not getting that bike.
Pete, you're such a fine player.
Michael Strahan is fun and friendly, but whenever he stepped onto a football field, he became focused and ferocious.
Welcome home, baby.
He spent 15 seasons terrorizing NFL quarterbacks, accumulating 141 and a half sacks along the way. He finished his career with more hardware than a Home Depot, winning countless honors, including a Defensive Player of the Year trophy, a Super Bowl ring, and the gold blazer that comes with induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Quite impressive for a kid who entered the league after only playing football for 1 year of high school and four at tiny Texas Southern University. Where were you for your own NFL draft?
For my own NFL draft, I was sitting in my Uncle Art's living room, and we just watched it on TV. It wasn't the big fanfare it is now. I wish it was, but it wasn't. And as you're sitting there, we didn't have call waiting. So you're watching the draft and people getting drafted, and then the phone rings. They're like, oh, here's my chance. And you pick it up, and it's one of your buddies going, hey, how'd they pick him, man? He should have picked you. You're like, get off the phone. They could be calling now. But it was a nerve-wracking, stressful situation.
What were your first thoughts when you found out you were going to go to the Giants?
Why? They have Lawrence Taylor, who is the greatest defensive player ever in the history of my mind. And also, it's cold. I don't want to freeze, man. I don't want smoke to come out of my mouth. It's cold in New York.
What do these names have in common? John Copeland, Eric Curry, Dan Williams, Chris Slade, and Coleman Rudolph.
All guys picked ahead of me.
You know how many of them are in the Hall of Fame? Exactly. Well, the Giants had, you know, like you said, Lawrence Taylor and some really star players when you joined them. What was your mindset, you know, when you first went into the locker room?
It's completely overwhelming. I'm walking in the locker room, I see Phil Simms, and he goes, hey, Michael. And I'm like, oh, my, Phil Simms knows my name. Oh, my goodness. And then Lawrence Taylor, he didn't walk in. It was like he just did like that, and he just glided in like he was on a one of those trams at the airport. The guy didn't have to move his legs. He was like a god. He was just floating into the room. So overwhelming, to say the least.
We see this sort of easygoing Michael on television. How does that differ from, you know, when you were on the football field?
I think a lot of this is on the football field. A lot of the smiling is on the football field, but not when I was the younger player.
Were you a smiling assassin?
Later in my career, yes.
Yeah.
But as a younger player, no, because I believe you had to be mad to play. I would look at the guy who I thought I had to play, and I would look at his picture in the program, and I would go, oh, he said something bad about my mama. You know, I'm kind of psyched myself up. Oh, he did. But after trying to do that for a few years, I'm thinking, oh, this is exhausting. So I had to figure out another way to get myself excited to play. And then it just came down to loving to compete. I love to compete. So we can have this conversation right here on the bench during the game. I have my helmet down there, and they'll go, ah, you know, defense. I go, all right, hold on 1 second. I'll be right back. Pick it up, put my helmet on, and then it's a different thing. It's more of a focus.
Right.
Now, and I can smile at you, but it's kind of like a lion looking at you where you could tell there's no concern or love for you in their eyes.
Yeah.
When, and it was that helmet made me go, I, you know, hey, how you doing, man? How's your wife? I don't really care about you right now, but I'm gonna handle you. Then the second I take it off when we get done, I put it out and we can continue our conversation. So it's just, you had to have switches, a different level to your personality to be able to compete at that level, but also stay calm.
At the end of the 2000 season, you make it to the Super Bowl. How exciting was that?
That was one of the best feelings of my life. We were a team that wasn't expected to do much in the playoffs, and we beat the Minnesota Vikings 41-0. It was just an amazing accomplishment by the entire team. Best feeling in the world.
How disappointing was it to lose?
Worst feeling in the world.
Was it?
You know, when you lose a Super Bowl, you wonder, was it even worth making it in the first place? If we had to come this far just to lose, but then you think about it, at least I had a chance at the end. But it was disappointing in the way we lost and the margin in which we lost with. But when I look back on it now, it was a blessing to lose then. Because I just don't think I would have continued my career as long as I did. I don't know if I would have had a lot of the same motivation that I did. It just seemed to work out perfectly. But to lose, it was devastating. It was just completely devastating.
When you started, one of your career goals was to break LT's sack record.
Being around long enough to break LT's record was, you know, that was kind of like icing on the cake. And that was the thing on a personal front I was most proud of in my NFL career, because he was my idol. Like, there was no other defensive player. I used to watch the videos in college. We used to go out here like a bunch of crazy dogs and have some fun. I mean, there was nobody like LT.
He was like the Tasmanian
devil. He was like the Tasmanian devil.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to play with this man and learn from this man, and to have him there on the sideline when I broke the record against the Eagles was like, wow, you know, yeah. Full circle of life, you know. And so without even knowing that was a goal, but then to accomplish it was beyond anything I ever imagined.
Golf's a funny game. You know, tell me a funny story about golf.
I was playing in Pennsylvania when I used to live out in the Poconos, and I'm hit a bad drive, and I'm so mad, and I throw my club, but it didn't go where I wanted. It kind of went here behind a fence into this tree that had all these crazy vines, and it got stuck in the tree.
Did you have to throw a provisional?
Well, the crazy thing is, there was no way to get to my club.
No way.
So every day, I played the course a lot. Every time I played that course, I had to look at my driver, which to this day, I'm like, never throw a club.
Is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there. That was God's lesson to me, that do not ever throw a club, son, because you will be humbled. But it's still there.
Thank you. Thank you. Because he hadn't played much organized football, Michael Strahan arrived in the NFL with raw athletic talent, unencumbered with bad habits. He was clay waiting to be molded, which made him a coach's dream. That is, until he ran into a coach who epitomized his worst nightmare. Let's say I just injected you with truth serum. How much did you hate Tom Coughlin when he came to coach the Giants?
Beyond anything I can tell you.
Really?
I'll never forget my first meeting with him. And he tells me, he gives me a notebook. And he said, I want you to write down everything that I'm going to say to you. And I was going on a trip, and he knew I was leaving. And he said, and then when you're on this plane ride, I want you to read this over and over again and think about it. And I had the notebook, and I'm just writing down BS, BS, BS. I'm just writing BS, 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 BS. And I left the meeting. I said to myself after that, I got to play this year with this guy because I'm under contract. And after that, I'm done. I can't play with this guy. I will not play for this guy for more than 1 year. And I hated him. I don't think anybody, no one didn't. He was a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day we had a big blow up for several reasons. One, he fined me $500 for being 3 minutes early instead of 5 minutes early. So we're going to practice, and I pull him aside and I say, hey, coach, I got a letter for a fine for $500 for being late, but I wasn't late. He goes, yes, you were. I said, coach, I wasn't late. I was 3 minutes early. He said, well, you're late. don't cut it close so close next time. Like, I'm not cutting it close. 8 o'clock is 8 o'clock. He finally says to me, he goes, well, be lucky, it could have been more. And when he said that, then my whole mentality went from player-coach relationship to player-enemy relationship. And I literally said, well, you know what? Screw it. Next time I'm late, I'll come in here when I want to. I'll run some errands. I'll go to IHOP and get some breakfast. I'll do what I want to do, and I'll show up here when I want to. And he goes, well, you can't talk to me like that. And I said, yes, I can. I said, you don't respect me, I'm not going to respect you. And you know what? Every time I talk to you and I tell you what's going on with the players, you always say, I hear you, I hear you. I said, I'm not stupid. You're just dismissing me. You're dismissing the team. But I got one thing to tell you. You're losing this team. Do you hear that? And I walked away from him. And from that moment on, our relationship did a complete turnaround. And at that time, all of a sudden, he started coming around kind of cracking jokes, being more personal with guys. And it was like, this is weird. We don't know how should we laugh, because it's like a friend who's a comedian who's not funny, but you got to laugh at their jokes, or is he really trying? And we found out he was really trying to connect with us at that point. And I know his wife had a nice talk with him about it. And I think that kind of changed his mindset. So we bought in. He bought in to us. And next thing you know, it just turned around the whole feeling around the organization.
By the time you'd finished your career, how much did you love him?
You know what? If I had to go back and play football, I would play for him in a heartbeat. Love him.
They say you have to lose a major in golf before you know how to win one. Do you have to lose a Super Bowl?
I prefer not to, but yeah. I did.
Did you learn
it helped
from
me. It helped. And I'll never forget it. It helped because the Super Bowl is so overwhelming if you hadn't been there before. So the first time you go, and it's like, oh, my God, it's the Super Bowl. Oh, and you're so nervous. And every step and every play, you're like, You're not free-flowing. You're not enjoying the game. You're not playing football. You're worried about everything outside of it because it seems so big. But when we went back, my final season, there were only three guys on our team, and there were only three that had ever been to a Super Bowl, myself, Amani Toomer, and Gray Rugemer. Coach Coughlin said, I want you three to address the team the week before and tell them what to expect. And my big message was basically, all these things that go on, you hear about how great the game is, and don't get overwhelmed. It's still just football. When they kick the ball off and all those light bulbs and flashing lights and all that, enjoy it. Stay loose. It's just a game.
Michael's final football game was Super Bowl 42, but the odds of a storybook ending seemed long. The Giants were 12-point underdogs to the mighty New England Patriots, who were 18-0 and looking to complete a perfect season. During the game, Michael let his actions do the talking. And then, with the Giants on the verge of one of the greatest upsets in NFL history, he had a message he wanted to deliver to his teammates.
Okay, 17-14, fellas. One touchdown, we are world champions.
Then, Eli Manning turned into Harry Potter, and he pulled off some on-field magic. Just as Michael had predicted on the sideline, 17-14 was the final score. And with the Super Bowl title to his credit, Michael no longer had anything to play for.
Guys were a little too loose for me going into the game. And I was surprised, but you know, in some ways, but I've never been on the field where it felt like all guys were in sync with each other on both sides of the ball for an entire game. It was the most amazing feeling I've ever had on a football field.
When you decided you didn't want to be on the football field anymore, was it because you felt you couldn't play or you didn't want to?
After 15 years, I had accomplished everything. I had every award that a defensive end or lineman that could win. I mean, player of the year, I led the league in sacks. I did everything from the Giants to the totality of the NFL. The only thing I hadn't done was won a Super Bowl, and we did it. And would it have been nice to go back and get like a victory round of the season, going to every stadium as a champion? Absolutely. But I used to give the stomp you out, pep talk before every game, get the players going. That was what held me back. I started to think more about the pep talk than playing. Playing would have been, you know, I could have managed. But I started thinking, do I have it in me to do another pep talk? Do I have it in me to get that energy up, to get guys going? I just didn't. And I didn't want to cheat football. Never cheated it. Always gave it everything. And I knew if I went back, I wouldn't have been myself. Yeah. And that was enough to make me say, okay, I'm out. I'm out.
More Faherty will continue after a few words from our sponsor. We've been doing Faherty for a while now, but every episode I learn something new from our guests. Just like Farmers Insurance knows a thing or two because they've seen a thing or two. So, thanks to Farmers for supporting my show.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
All right then, now back to the show.
All right, Michael, this is rapid fire. You get the drill. Let somebody start a clock somewhere. Who's the best golfer among football players?
Me.
Good answer. A word to describe what it was like to meet Muhammad Ali?
Breathtaking.
What's your favorite car?
1971 Ferrari Daytona.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What's that car worth?
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
The hardest part of doing a morning talk show is?
Waking up.
That's what I thought that would be. Who was the toughest player you ever lined up against?
Eric Williams, Dallas Cowboys.
How many touchdowns did you score?
3 or 4.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Beer or wine?
Neither.
Yeah. What's your favorite club?
Ooh, boy, favorite club. Oh, I haven't been to a club in a while, but I've had some good nights at One Oak.
Peyton or Eli?
Eli, man. Eli won me 2 rings. I love Peyton, but Eli all the way.
Yeah. Instagram or Twitter?
Instagram.
Tom Brady, healthy respect or unabashed hatred?
Healthy respect.
How would you do on Dancing with the Stars?
Crush it. I would win.
You would?
Yeah, I'm limble. I'm limber, and I'm light on my feet.
Who would play you in the Michael Strahan movie?
Denzel Washington or Will Smith? Michael B. Jordan? Somebody good looking.
Yeah. Who's the best sports writer?
Jay Glazer.
The best Irish talk show host with spectacular hair?
You.
That's a lucky guess.
You got the hint.
Well, that's it. As always.
That's it?
You win nothing. Stop the clock.
What? Why did I answer those? I didn't get anything.
We met golf club.
Golf club.
Oh,
I'm like, damn. We were talking about drinks, and
I wasn't paying attention. I'm kind of lucky in that, you know, I mean, golf's a funny game. It just makes you look like an idiot. Is football a funny game?
Yeah, but you know what's weird about golf, man? And I love playing golf, but right when I think I got it, then I don't.
Yeah.
Literally, I'm playing well. Oh, my swing is on fire today. My putting's great.
But that never changes. Doesn't matter how good you are at it. You know, the game always feels that way.
Yeah, but that blows my mind, because football, I felt like, not that I mastered it, but you know what? Because I can be consistent. Golf, I'll be smashing a driver. And then I'll get out there and I'll say, what is this thing in my hands? What do they call this? I can't hit it. I don't understand it. Golf is the hardest, trickiest sport, and it goes to show how mentally challenging the game of golf is, which people need to appreciate a lot more.
Is that what attracts you to the game?
I love the competitiveness about it. You're competing not necessarily against an opponent, which of course you're, but you're competing against the course.
And yourself.
And yourself.
Yeah.
And I just like that it's a unifier, and not only a unifier, it's an equalizer. So you can have a guy who's 5'2", who hits it a lot further, like Rory McIlroy hit it a lot further than I will ever hit it. And you'll look and go, how is that possible? Mm. And very few sports are like that.
When and where did you learn the game?
I kind of got into it by mistake. I was invited to a lot of golf tournaments, always said no. Invited to go out and play with people, always said no, because I figured everybody was good. Everybody tells you, oh, my handicap, I'm a 6, I'm a 7, I'm a 8, I'm a 10. And I was always intimidated because I'd never picked up a club. And the friend of mine said, hey, why don't you come out and play with me? So, okay, whatever. I went out and played with this guy, and I realized everybody sucks.
Everybody sucks. You're meant to suck.
Yeah. Everybody kind of sucks at this. And from then, I was hooked, because once you get hooked on, you want to get the right swing, you want to get the right feel.
Yeah.
When you need nothing better than every round of golf, I don't care how bad your round is going, you can shoot 150. I guarantee, close to the end or at the end of that round, you will hit one shot that will make you go,
that brings you back.
Oh, I can get this. I got this. Oh, that felt too good.
Is there a difference between football playing golfers, baseball playing golfers, or basketball playing golfers?
It depends on the position.
Yeah?
Yeah. Baseball playing golf. I remember Ken Griffey Jr. a long time ago. I said, hey, you can do how's your golf game? He goes, well, I swing for a living, you know? So that was his answer. And football players, quarterbacks are good and kickers are good because they don't get hit. Mm. For me, I'm getting banged up. I'm lifting weights every day.
Yeah.
So your body's constantly changing. You're constantly sore. So once we get to the point where we're playing golf, it's after you're retired.
Right.
You know, body's beat up and old. But it is something that I wish I'd taken up when I was a kid.
I hear that all the time.
To learn the game of golf.
Who is Chris Mamalanga?
Ex-teammate.
Yeah.
Ex-teammate, ex-lineman, defensive tackle. He loved to fight. And I think he just had an issue with me because I was just like very chill. I come in, mind my own business. And he was just pushing me and pushing me. And then eventually, I'm like, you know what? You're still a rookie. Why are you talking to me? And he literally came up. He's like, well, you think you can whip me? And I'm like, hey. I mean, I can't say no in my head now, David. I'm like, whew, I really don't want to fight this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, I'm not trying to fight you, but if you come at me, we're going to have to go. And eventually, after back and forth of that, he swung, and I ducked. And then I grabbed him and threw him. And, you know, once you're in control, you start, I told you not to mess with, you know, I got cocky then. I got really cocky. But it took a lot out of him because players thought he was invincible, and I think he did too. And I felt bad for that, but I didn't feel bad for defending myself. And my teammates, I remember them saying, man, I would have bet the house on him. I didn't know you had that in you. Because, you know, I kind of go through things kind of very even keel, man.
Each week during the season, Terry is one of four Hall of Famers on the set for Fox NFL Sunday. One of the others is Michael Strahan, who's almost as good on camera as he was on the field. Did you always intend to go into broadcasting after your playing career had ended?
No.
How did it happen?
I started doing stuff when I was playing here in New York. I mean, yeah. Big city, you get asked to do certain things, and they would ask me, oh, would you like to come on this program or do, oh, okay, great. And it was fun. I started having fun doing it. And back then, Fox used to have a show called The Best Damn Sports Show, mm-hmm. period. And I just fell in love with the way the whole thing worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly am like a extroverted introvert.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, get in front of the camera and like, whoa.
My son, Michael, and I are making sure that everyone in New York is eating good.
Well, it all started with you doing commercials with your mom, really, didn't
it? Yeah. And that was fun. My mom, Louise Strahan, the first time we did a Chunky Soup commercial was in a subway in New York. And my mom had one line. You need a hot bowl of Chunky Soup to fill you up right. That's what
I remember it, yeah.
And we both had our own, trailers. She brought up a friend of hers who was like her pseudo agent. And and I go in my mom's trailer and I go, oh, you big time now. You get your own trailer, huh? And I said, you want to run the lines? No, boy, I got this. I said, Mom, you've never acted. She go, I've been acting like your mom the whole time. So I was like, okay. She gets out there, they go, action. And man, you need a hot bowl of Chunky Soup to fill you up right. That's what you get without being prepared.
Easy.
But then she became comfortable. So we would do commercials throughout the city. I was walking on 59th Street with a microwave on my shoulder, my uniform with my mom, like that was part of one of the commercials. That's one of the proudest things I've ever done because whenever you can include your family, especially your mom, in an iconic campaign like that, It was a fantastic feeling because I shared that with my mom.
I can see the transition from the football field to the football analyst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's less apparent to me is the transition to like morning TV host. How does that happen?
Well, I went on live with Regis and Kelly after we won the Super Bowl. And I always joke with them and say, well, it's probably true, though. Only reason I went on, because Eli Manning wasn't available. So I went on, had a great time as a guest. And I said, you know what? If Regis ever takes a break and goes on vacation like I know he does, I would love to come in and co-host for a day.
So you suggested it?
Yeah, I suggested it.
Good for you.
But it took a year later before I ever heard anything back. And apparently, they ran out of people to ask. So they came to me. And I went on, and the hour went by like that. And when I was done, I said, boy, I hope I get a chance to do that again.
Well, I knew you were comfortable on the show when I saw you auditioning for Magic Mike.
Oh, boy, you know saw it. That was a joke that ended up being a reality. I was just I wasn't even a full-time host of the show. I was still just like a guy they called in to help. whenever they needed a host, and Channing Tatum's on the show, and I'm like, oh, you know what'd be funny? I'm in the back with the producer. I say, you know what'd be funny? I can say, hey, you know, I'm the real Magic Mike. You know, in college, and I rip off my pants. And they're going, you would do that? I'm like, yeah. They're like, oh, if you're willing to do it, we'll have it ready by tomorrow. And I'm like, can I put my foot in my mouth? Kelly had no idea I was going to do it. Channing had no idea I was going to do it. But I did it.
Oh, I mean, you went at it. I mean, you went 100%.
They say that me doing that helped me get the job. At that point, they realized I was willing to have fun. I didn't take myself too seriously.
And as we told you earlier this week, we had big news. Our good friend Michael Strahan is joining us full time here at
Why do you think you're so comfortable doing it?
I just think because I've already had a career, and this I look at as gravy. Like, I get there, and it's not that I'm nervous. I'm not scared. I'm not thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm going to lose my job. Because, hey, if I do, good. It's fine. Life goes on. And I don't take myself too seriously, and I don't take work too seriously. And, you know, I just try to live and enjoy every day and go to work and do the best I can. And then when I leave work, I enjoy myself when I'm not there. Then I get back the next day and give it everything I got again.
Is there a parallel between the team you played on, the Giants, and the team at GMA?
Yeah. I think the greatest thing about sports is I learned so much about teamwork and how to make everyone feel valuable. I don't care if it's a guy who's a practice squad guy who will only get you ready for your opponent but will never play in a game. Everyone wants to feel valuable and know they are contributing. And that's the same thing that is at GMA. And I love the aspect of depending on other people at GMA, just like I had to depend on people on the football field, and to have those relationships where if I miss something, I know you can pick it up. And I know you have my back.
Yeah. Who were you most excited to interview?
I mean, I'm kind of a big fan of so many people. I mean,
And you've interviewed so many.
Hard. I know. Yeah.
People ask me what my favorite interview is, and I'm like, hell, changes.
Yeah, it changes.
Yeah.
But I just appreciate talented people. So, I mean, Hugh Jackman, always love talking to Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
Matt Damon's always a fun interview. Julia Roberts, she mesmerizes you. But there are times that I'm in the middle of an interview, and I'll go, oh my gosh, I'm talking to this person.
Yes. I know that feeling. I know.
Yeah, it's like, it's crazy. You haven't lived until you see Terry Bradshaw in your underwear.
In his underwear? No, or I've seen him without his underwear.
Yeah.
He keeps getting naked.
Well, Terry did this commercial, and he's out right now where you can get those bathtubs nice. That you step into.
I've already told him I'm getting one.
No, but you know what he did? They were like, okay, we need Mr. Bradshaw. You got to get in the tub.
He didn't.
They said all they hear is, oh, Mr. Bradshaw's naked. Mr. Bradshaw's naked. He didn't understand. You get in with your underwear on. Terry stripped down naked in front of the room and gets in the tub.
He doesn't care. In 2014, Michael got the call that every player dreams of getting. An invitation to Canton, Ohio, for induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Being inducted into the Hall of Fame has got to be obviously one of the coolest things. But do you ever wear that vomit-colored jacket?
You know, I gotta say, the color is kind of like,
it's not good.
Who came up with this color?
But sports jackets in general are awful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the green jackets.
Green jacket.
You know, you can't wear that anywhere. The tartan jackets, you know, that you get.
Maybe that's why. They don't want you to wear it anywhere except when you need to wear it for them. I've only worn it when necessary.
Right.
Like a Hall of Fame something or something football related. I would never wear that jacket anywhere else.
But it has to be cool to own one.
It is so cool to own one. And the coolest moment, giving your speech to the crowd at the Hall of Fame is incredible because you get to thank your family and your friends, and you have all these people who fly out there to support you. But the coolest moment at the Hall of Fame, to me, was when they're announcing you, and you walk down these stairs, and you walk through a line of all the Hall of Famers.
Right.
And guys are hugging you and patting you on your back and shaking your hands, and you're just, it's surreal. Like, oh my God, these are people I grew up and admired.
Yeah.
And a lot I played against, some were before me, but the admiration is completely there. Then you go into a center stage, you walk down, you go back up onto a center stage, and your presenter puts your jacket on you. And for me, my presenter was Jay Glazer, who was my best friend here in New York. We met when he was a rookie writer and I was a rookie player. And he's helped me through so much as a player. And but it was special to have Jay put that jacket on me for the first time after walking through a sea of Hall of Famers. That was the most memorable Hall of Fame moment for me.
People always say to me, you know, I love to go to Ireland, I love to go to Scotland, you know, the golf courses are great. The metropolitan area in New
York
has the best collection of golf courses in the world,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned. What are some of your favorites?
And they're classics like, you know, Wingfoot.
Yeah.
I love playing Wingfoot. Then if you go out to the Hamptons, then there's National, and there's Sabonic, and there's Shinnecock, and all, which is extremely hard. The places I play the most around here, I play Hudson National. Mm-hmm. I love Hudson. Hamilton Farm, which is out in Jersey, which I love, and one of the only, if not the only, PGA-rated par three courses in the country, which is a lot of fun to play and work on your iron game. I like Bayonne for being close to the city, and it's kind of the Link style, old school, great views of the city and Statue of Liberty and all that, but it's kind of weird, but in a sense, I kind of like you don't hit your driver until the fourth hole. In this area, it's such great golf courses that you're never at a shortage.
Superb. I remember Hudson National, actually. It was one of the last rounds of golf I ever played. God, it had to be 15 years ago.
Well, the first time I played there, I thought I'd never play here again.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was ridiculous. It's so hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
It was the fairway of fescue.
Yeah.
I wasn't good enough to be out there at the time. I said, I'll never play this course again. Now I'm a member at the course. And then off to Albany in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
I did the same thing. I'll never play here again. Now I'm a member at Albany. So if I come to your course and say I'll never play there again, I'll probably become a member if you let me.
How many times a year do you play?
When it's warm enough, I would actually probably play 5 or 6 if I can get away with it.
Yeah.
But I play between 3 and 4 times a week.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of golf.
I get out quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then vacation, I play just about every day if I can.
How did you come to have your own clothing line, and why am I not wearing it?
Okay, like you, you're a very fashionable man, and I am in suits every day. So we created this tailored line by Michael Strahan, and it just has done extremely well. I mean, it's blown us away with how fast it's grown in 3 years. But when I'm not working, I like to be more casual, so we created MSX, which is an athleisure line.
Every brand has a logo, if you like, and your logo, if you like, is your teeth.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
It's a recognizable thing. And when did you come to embrace that?
When I was in the league the first few years, I was getting it fixed. I was going to get it fixed. I went to the dentist, the team dentist. He did a whole mock-up of everything so I could see what I would look like with my teeth straight.
Wouldn't be the same.
It wouldn't be the same.
No.
And I had a little cap I had a dentist make one time that I could put in there. So, like, trying to disguise myself didn't work. But I realized I couldn't even talk. My tongue needs room now. It's just so used to, you know, having a part in the bars.
Yeah.
So it needs some room to talk. But it's my trademark now. If I had my teeth fixed, I don't think I would be the same. I just think it would just kill my personality.
Yeah.
And I don't even realize I have a gap anymore.
Yeah. Well, every time I come to New York, I get buried under the lip in Saks Fifth Avenue, and I always need more luggage as a result.
I can help you.
Yeah?
Hey, I brought you a gift.
That's so cool.
Thank you, Drew. Thank you. So I brought you a gift. A little luggage here. Let's do this.
So everything here, including the suitcase, is your collection?
Yes, suitcase is a collection. I travel every weekend for football from New York to L.A. for 5 months every weekend. So luggage was a natural fit for what I do. Jeans, I love to be comfortable.
32.
Now you're going to like these underwear, buddy.
Oh, yeah?
Silky, fine.
That's beautiful.
Then here are some boxes. I don't know. I figure you're, I don't know what your style is, but very silky.
Nice. And
little camo hoodie.
Those feel nice. Oh, that's a hoodie.
Yeah,
beautiful.
The hoodie.
Thank you. A vest. Yeah, baby.
Keep it coming. We got jeans for you.
Oh, man.
A little bit of everything. So,
God, you're all over it.
And the best thing, you're going to love these.
Yeah?
And your wife's going to love them. The pajamas, man.
Oh.
You wear those around the house?
Cool.
She's going to say, who's that sexy beast?
Thank you, buddy.
I appreciate you, man. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's really nice. Ferocious defensive end and teddy bear morning television personality seem like polar opposite careers to me. So how is it that one man can do them so well? After speaking with Michael, I think I figured it out. Both rely on two things, hard work and optimism. And Michael has those in abundance. He's tireless in his preparation and always believes that the best is yet to come. Whether he's giving a pre-game locker room pep talk or interviewing a celebrity, he'll make sure you believe it too. Thanks for joining me, Feherty fans. That's our show for tonight. You can catch me on Facebook, Instagram, and FeherTwit. You can also find more Feherty podcasts presented by Farmers Insurance on Feherty.com and your favorite podcast provider. Go to Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Art19, or Google Play. Search Feherty and subscribe. If you love the show, why wouldn't you? Be sure to leave a rating.